time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
Welcome to Paris, Joseph.
Monsieur, I fear this will not be a kind place to such a boy.
The boy has talents, but one in particular that is exceptional.
Very well.
I realized the more I excelled, the less I was alone.
Were you always so competitive?
The show-off who spoiled Mozart's concert.
May I play with you, monsieur?
Well, I hope this won't be embarrassing for you. Who the hell is that?
You are quite a remarkable man, Joseph.
I, Marie Antoinette, Queen of France, hereby anoint you Chevalier.
In any other country, a man of your color would not be wearing such fine clothes.
One day, the whole world will know me.
And of course, the music will be spectacular. Bold.
You don't belong here.
You're a party trick. You're a pet playing the violin. That is all.
You know I am the best.
You are playing a dangerous game, friend.
You forget your place, boy. Break his hands.
This world is painful for us, my son. But there is always the choice to fight.
I'm putting on a concert. Let us fund the revolution.
We cannot afford to make any more enemies.
France is changing.
You could be more influential than you know. Leverage it.
If you take to the stage, you will be erased. There will be no new France. You cannot topple what has been ordained by God.
Not everything is about you people.
Okay, so we've just heard the trailer to Chevalier. We'll be talking about Chevalier in a few moments, hopefully, assuming Richard Fitzwilliams connects and does his wonderful thing. Although I have to say, I'm just a little bit disappointed that Chevalier wasn't about Maurice Chevalier and, of course, his classic line, "Saint-Gavin for little girls," as indeed portrayed in the movie Gigi. But no, it wasn't. It's about something completely different and more in tune with Mozart and Salieri than indeed the world of Gigi. However, talking about worlds and multiverses, let's jump, quite literally take a spider jump, into the new incarnation of the multiverse with, of course, loads and loads and loads of Spider-Man and women and folk and various other things in a mind-blowing expansion in which everything happens everywhere all at once, quite literally, in the Spider-Verse that is there and will be described eruditely and accurately, I'm sure, by our ace Antipodean correspondent, Natasha Wanton. Go, Natasha!
My name is Miles Morales. I'm Brooklyn's one and only Spider-Man. And things are going great.
Oh, yeah. You were supposed to be here at 5.
All right, whatever.
Whatever?
Wow.
Whatever?
So are you like a cow or a Dalmatian?
I am the spot.
That's not funny. Don't do that.
Miles' grades are pretty good. A in AP Physics.
That's my little man.
And a B in Spanish.
What?
Ooh, okay.
Miles.
Are you trying to...
Mira, eso es imposible.
I gotta go. All right, bye.
He's lying to you. And I think you know it.
What's up, danger?
Miles!
Wanna get out of here?
Oh, when? Spider-Man, there's an elite crew with all the best spider people in it?
Who's the new guy?
This is unbelievable.
This is the lobby. Miguel O'Hara. The whole thing was his idea.
What's a guy gotta do to join this spider team?
You can never be part of this.
Don't even get me started on Doctor Strange and the little nerd back on Earth 199999.
Come on, go easy on the kid. He had a terrible teacher.
Peter!
Miles!
Mayday! You have a baby?
I have a baby.
No puedo más, no puedo más.
I'll take it from here. Miles, being Spider-Man is a sacrifice.
You have a choice between saving one person and saving every world.
Send me home.
I can't do that.
I can do both! Spider-Man, always...
Not always.
What about Uncle Ben?
If not for Uncle Ben, most of us wouldn't be here.
Can't stop me now!
You can't run forever, kid!
I can't lose one more friend.
Miguel, this isn't what we talked about!
You knew?
I had no idea what you're doing!
Everyone keeps telling me how my story is supposed to go. Nah. I'm gonna do my own thing.
All stations, stop Spider-Man.
You want me?
And then I looked at my uncle and...
Let me guess. He died.
Hi, yes. So this is Sony's sequel to the 2018 Into the Spider-Verse, which was such a big success. This, of course, being an animated series that is affiliated to the Marvel comic book universe, but has nothing to do with Disney and the actual Marvel series, as far as we know for now. That, of course, being until Sony and Disney decide to actually put their handbags down and decide to work together. But who knows when that will happen. So this pretty much kicks off fairly soon after the end of the first one. You will need to probably know some of the major plot points for the first one, but it's not pivotal that you watch the whole thing. You can understand this one without having to watch the first one, but there might be a few bits that you might sort of think, oh, I wonder how that happened, or what's going on here? So there might be a couple of minutes the way you're like, not sure, but for the rest, you can generally understand most of the plot. Plot, of course, being lots of Spider-Man, lots of worlds. So we start off on Earth 65 with Gwen Stacy. This is Gwen Stacy's world. She, of course, coming back from the first movie as the sort of friend, love interest sort of character. She's living with her father, who's a police captain. And he's desperately trying to hunt down the killer of her best friend, Peter Parker, who in this universe, we find out, has tragically died. He transformed himself into a lizard at prom and was crushed by a building. And while Gwen tried to save him, he died. Unfortunately, her father, the police captain, walked in during this and thought she was the killer. So ever since then, he's been on a bit of a witch hunt trying to find the Spider Woman. So as she's on duty one night, she comes across a rather peculiar sight. She meets Vulture, but not Vulture from her world, not Vulture from Earth 65. It's Vulture from the Italian Renaissance, it seems. He's quite an interesting character. And not very happy to be found in a modern, what most people would consider a modern art museum. It's obviously to him being an Italian Renaissance. It's not what he would consider art. And he starts trashing it. Of course, Gwen steps in to try and stop him. And she is helped by two mysterious figures, one of which is Miguel O'Hara. And the other is a Spider-Woman by the name of Jess Drew. And it seems that they have these magic sort of portal watches that allow them to stabilize and travel to other realms. The fight obviously goes awry, and it's found out by her father that she's Spider-Woman. He panics and tries to arrest her. And in the process, she freaks out and manages to escape with Michael O'Hara and Jess Drew to this sort of Spider-Man sanctuary where all the Spider-Men sort of get together, the Spider Society, if you like. And that's where we sort of get the title scene. So there's a lot happening in the first few minutes before we even get to Miles. We then meet Miles in Earth 16110. And it's about 6 months after the events of the last film. He's really struggling with being found out that, you know, he doesn't want to be found out by his parents that he's Spider-Man, but he's more and more he's struggling to hide that he's Spider-Man, and he's feeling like it's all going to come to a head. It's causing a lot of conflict in his home life. Alongside this, he encounters a new villain, but he doesn't really take him very seriously. The villain goes by the name of Spot, and he was an Alchemax scientist whose body was infused with parts of the portal after the collider exploded. This happened sort of at the end of the first movie. So that's kind of the bit I was talking about where you need to know a little bit about what happened in the first one, but not too much. And Miles doesn't really take Spot really seriously. He's a bit of a joke, a bit of a goof, can't really control his powers, thinks nothing of it, wraps him up for the police with a nice little bow, and off he goes to get back to his personal dramas and conflicts at home. And then up turns Gwen, which he wasn't expecting to see because he thought everyone went back to their own worlds and, you know, that was that. But he's missed her terribly and he's very excited to see her. However, Gwen doesn't seem as excited to see him. In fact, she tries to sort of shake him off a couple of times and sort of step around a couple of questions. He sort of loosely works out that she's working for somebody, but she doesn't really want to give him the details. And so he's forced to follow her. And in doing so, he finds out that she's been on a secret mission the whole time to try and guard Spot. And as you can see, this is where it starts to escalate. Spot, who was the goofy villain, is starting to be seen as, oh, maybe there's something more there. And I will stop there before we sort of
pivotal,
get to any
pivotal
sort of
to the
spoilers.
Whole essence of the whole scenario. Kathy Manso, yes. Have you been to see the Spider-Verse as yet?
I have not been to see the Spider-Verse. I'm sure it's going to be really good, though.
I mean, certainly financially, it's doing extraordinarily well. Richard Fitzwilliams, do you feel as though just the very notion of a villain, or is he a villain called Spot, could well actually entice you to say, yes, if only that kind of content had been present in Archie Wells' Spotify productions, Spotify would not have cancelled the Duchess of Sussex series?
They might very well not have, because as you say, Spider-Verse has made a lot of money, and unfortunately, at least so far as Spotify was concerned, the Sussexes haven't been good value for money, and what is worse, rumours that Netflix, they've only produced, you can remember Pearl was pulled, it was her animated series, they've only produced one six-hour docuseries for Netflix. This might be big news, and also there might be big news of them getting other contracts, and as you know, that full of this in the paper.
The key, of course, is in the word spot, Natasha. See the connection there? The spot it, and Spotify. This is, again, where
need.
We start blending those universes together. And indeed, in one of those universes, I think Richard Fitzwilliams is indeed the Uncle Ben character who says, with great power comes great responsibility.
I could see that. I could definitely see that.
So
he's
what,
got the
what
nobility
kind
of the character. So this was an interesting one for me because I thought it was going to be good going into it. There's been a lot of hype. There's been a lot of positive feedback. So I was expecting good things from it because everyone's sort of given it such amazing feedback. I'm going to go with a 9 because several reasons. I found it incredibly engrossing to the point where I didn't actually know that it ended until they rolled the ending credits. The ending of this one's a doozy. I'm not going to give you spoilers, but it's a doozy. And suffice to say, they're making another one, Spider-Man Beyond the Spider-Verse, set for release in March next year. So if you watch this one, you're definitely going to watch that one. And that's all I'll say in regards to the ending. But
so
no,
will,
I, it
will
was
Richard
really
need
good.
To immerse himself fully in the spider lore as created originally by Steve Ditko and Stan Lee and all of the multiverse incarnations so that he can come together with Miguel O'Hara and Miles Morales and the various incarnations of Spider-Man, including, of course, Peter Parker and his first lost love, Gwen Stacy?
Well,
I can only say that this
something
is
to do when you're at Royal Ascot, perhaps, Richard, to read up on the Spider-Verse when you're in between races and such like.
I mean, this is a sort of torture for me, Alex. That's why you're suggesting it. That's why you want to put the thumbscrews on me. I know
how much you loved Everything Everywhere All at Once, so I know you actually appreciate the joys of the multiverse where everything happens simultaneously in all sorts of marvelous ways.
It's the very last thing I would see voluntarily. I mean, that it has enormous appeal. I mean, I'm delighted because, frankly, some of the movies, including the ones I'm going to be talking about, I mean, when I saw them...
Somehow, Richard, I feel that actually you were telling a slight porky there, because surely you would actually prefer... Are you actually saying you'd prefer to go and see Nicole Kidman singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow in preference to the multiverse of Spider-Verse?
I didn't mention that at all. It had just been mischievous. What I said was that, unfortunately, the movies I had seen, there was no one else there, almost no one else there. That's the trouble.
Seriously. I will say, Richard, it was so bad trying to get a seat for this movie. Two weekends I tried to get this movie. Every cinema I tried to go to, back-to-back, sold out. I could not get a seat for 2 weeks. I had to go out of my usual cinema and go across town and pay lots of money for a special cinema to actually get a seat in this place. And even then, that was pretty sold out. It was the last couple of seats. So it's really doing well, this movie. It's really bringing people in. I can see why. Because the animation style is so stunning and the characters...
Many animation styles.
Many animation styles, but all done really well. And each world seems to have a really clearly defined art style. It's very beautiful to look at. And I think that that's really nice. It's part of the craftsmanship of the different worlds that you see. You don't see too many of them either, which Doctor Strange kind of sometimes can throw them all a bit at you, whereas this one, it seemed to handle it in a way that wasn't too confusing. So, but I would say the art style and the sort of the dialogue and the story, it's all been really, really well done. As I say, I've given it a 9. So, and it's just so lovely to see such full cinemas. So I was annoyed that I couldn't get a seat, but I was also really happy because it showed that it was doing so well. But Just more money for me to pay, but it's all good.
Natasha, we need to get your press pass. Kathy, is this one for you?
Yeah, honestly, I've been hearing a lot of hype about it. I think even a lot of my friends have gone and seen it too, and it was the same problem. They also struggled to get a seat together. Like, they can go in big groups. They kind of decided to go in pairs. So as soon as my life calms down, which I think in a week it will, I will happily want to see it.
And as I said at the start, having actually listened to, obviously, the trailer now for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse and so on, second part of the Spider-Verse trilogy, I was devastated to find that Chevalier is not a dedication to the great late Maurice Chevalier, Saint-Gervain for Little Girl, but indeed, as I say, interplays with the whole wonderment of a kind of Salieri-esque battle with Mozart, and indeed a historical figure who goes back to France. And Richard, tell us about Chevalier and why you would rate this, but very few people would like to go and see it, because obviously there's just no spider people in there.
Well, there are, however, real-life people, and there is a fascinating story here. I mean, this is an extraordinary film. I have to say it's a deeply flawed film, and that's a great pity, because the story, the real-life story of a French Caribbean musician, a black musician who was Joseph Boulogne, Chevalier de Saint-Georges, created it by Marie Antoinette. This was at the period of the Ancien regime in France, and indeed after the revolution. He was in charge of one black regiment in the Revolutionary Army, and that was extraordinary because he'd been previously a confidant of Marie Antoinette, it is said, and certainly a truly, truly remarkable musical figure, and also a first-class fencer. We know that John Adams, who was in fact, played by Paul Giamatti, the remarkable series, which I would recommend, was in fact high in his praise. But the facts are that I bet no one has heard of him. I haven't heard of him. The reason was that Napoleon brought back slavery and had a particular interest in eliminating all his work that he possibly could, apparently. So there's no doubt we see him brought to France originally by father. I mean, he's born to an enslaved mother and her French owner in the French island of Guadeloupe. He's enrolled at a boarding school in Paris, and he excels in violin competition and also in fencing. The film begins, and I mean, this is actually where it becomes so, I think, a mistake There's a dramatic confrontation with Mozart, where Mozart quite literally is all but laughed off stage because the Chevalier is so brilliant. Now, this never happened. They did apparently meet, but we know that, because at one time they stayed in the same home. But there wasn't this, and it's the need to overegg what is in fact an absolutely fascinating story anyway that makes this film certainly nothing like as good as it could or should have been, but it is nonetheless fantastic, because after this duel, and there's certain scenes showing the racism he was subjected to, but also the revolutionary fervor starting to sweep France, it's becoming rather dangerous to be close to Marie Antoinette. Even so,
lots of cake to eat there, Richard.
Well, he has an affair with the Marquise de Montalbert, who is very influential when it comes to putting on operas. Her husband, the Marquis, played by Martin Scorsese, is particularly suspicious of him. There could be trouble to come there. But also, his mother comes back to France after his father's death and awakens him to what's going on in Paris. Facts are, however, that he starts to fall out with Marie Antoinette when he'd intended, and apparently this was a real possibility, that he became the next leader of the Paris Opera. Now, because of racism, he was rejected. But when in this film Marie Antoinette can support him, he starts to go move to the revolutionary side. The movie, basically, by the end of it, he's practically starting the revolution himself. And that is where, again, a fascinating story with costumes and scenery and lighting and decor that is absolutely thrilling is always let down by its script. Kelvin Harrison Jr., he plays basically someone who's white but has a black skin in the first half of the film, and then in the second half he starts to rediscover his revolutionary roots and roots as a person of color. You therefore create somebody who did exist, whom we don't know, and do so very, very spectacularly. And I say they've really gone to town on the production values here. The trouble is that if you talk to Marie Antoinette as though she was anybody, I mean, she wasn't, and we know what happened to her, but the facts are that if you don't get the head of the ship of the Paris Opera, and then afterwards you get drunk and start shouting at her and behaving as you might in a Hollywood movie, this was where Babylon was also badly let down, but you have this very, very silly scenes. It's a terrible scene, and what the scene shows is that the person writing the script simply had very little understanding of the class structure at the time. I mean, it's a movie that, yes, it performed well enough. Ronke Adekunjolo as Nanon, his mother, and Alex Fitzalan as Philippe, who's introduces him to revolutionary politics. Even Minnie Driver, a rather sinister figure, pops up. It all is impressive. And the real life story is absolutely riveting, because I was reading that after the movie. But as a movie, this is very much a movie that doesn't fulfill the potential that it really ought to, because a lot of this is very, very bogus. But it's spectacular and it's colourful, and from that point of view, well worth seeing.
And yet maybe on Earth 1612, perhaps it does. Natasha Wanton, Chevalier. No need to queue for tickets, apparently. Is it one you're going to be checking out?
You see, Richard sort of confirmed my suspicions from seeing the trailer, because I was watching the trailer thinking, well, this looks marvellous as a source of entertainment, like utterly very, very interesting. But it looks like it's going to fall down the similar historical fiction trap of being a load of hyped nonsense. And unfortunately, it seems that it's gone that way. I will probably watch it just because I think the characters look quite compelling, although I'm not sold on the Marie Antoinette performance. From what I saw of the trailer, she looked quite a caricature, and that kind of irritated me quite profoundly, because she's quite an interesting historical figure. But I will watch it, but I think it's one of those ones where I'm going to have to watch it and switch my brain off, sadly, so that I don't get annoyed by the inaccuracies and just think of it as a completely anachronistic thing and just treat it as entertainment, which is a shame, because I think when you get material like this that is so riveting and these stories suddenly that are so new and so wonderful, and I think they could have the potential to, you know, be huge, it's silly then unfortunate that it gets ruined by Hollywood just wanting to make it all pretty and sparkly. And
strange that Hollywood doesn't really do that with historical fictions. It's obviously very focused on historical accuracy. Kathy, from the country that effectively learned everything it needed to know to rebel against the British from the French in terms of their revolution, liberté, égalité, fraternité. Any thoughts on yourself for this one?
Hey, if it was up to Benjamin Franklin, the U.S. would be speaking more French, but that's another story for another time. I think I agree with everyone. I thought I was definitely fascinated by the trailer. It looked very pretty, but I don't think you watch it for the historical aspect, you know? I mean, I think it's like a fun thing, which is why they get to have these beautiful sets and costumes, and it makes it even more entertaining. But I love watching historical fiction. I do, but you do have to turn off your brain for it. Like, I'm a sucker for anything that involves the Romanov family, anything that involves I love going deeper into that. But like, we also know, if we're gonna make those kind of comparisons, Anastasia was never a real story. We now have Harry and Meghan evidence. Well, we have the historical evidence that she died, unfortunately, very young with the rest of her family. Although I'd like to think, maybe. But I think if you're watching it more for the nod to history, and you just kind of want to go into the storyline and the characters' interactions, why not? So for me, I'll just wait for it to get available for streaming, and then, you know,
so much more important to do that. Streaming market is where it rules, unless of course you're the Sussexes, in which case it doesn't, but never mind. Richard, 6 out of 10 for this one, or are you going to go to a 7?
I'm going to a 7 because of the story, but I'm afraid that, you know, just to give you one more example of how this movie is supposed to fit into Hollywood's politically correct theme, when the mother of the Chevalier returns, she realizes that because he imitates the Ancien Régime types who are about to get guillotined, the revolution hasn't happened yet, he nonetheless stiff and formal and all the rest of it. He has to relax, and she takes him outside, and there's this whole street of persons of color calypso dancing, with all the close-ups that you'd expect and the way he becomes spontaneous and so forth. The problem is that first, it obviously didn't happen, but it didn't matter. The point is that it is such an obvious device. And just like the end of the film, where you've got the camera swaying with revolutionary fervor because he gives a concert, which Marie Antoinette attends, by the way, and has to walk out of. That's a sort of silly scene where it's a fascinating story, a real-life figure who was completely, whose existence was completely suppressed, and fascinating. Kevin Harrison Jr. definitely does his best. I think it was rather good.
Well, and that's the issue with the historical drama, sorry, just to point in, that is that someone unsuspectingly is going to watch that and think that's actually the historical fact. And that's the thing that really bugs me when Hollywood does this, is that people are going to think that that's gospel truth. Sorry, just ranting.
No, it's true, because also where you have just a bit of script, it's excruciating. When she Marie Antoinette, played very badly by Lucy Boynton, talks to Mozart about, talks to the Chevalier about his instrument. These sort of, it's a heavy-handed dialogue that becomes really, really painful. And, you know, there he is shouting at her and all the rest of it in front of everyone, and also something that you'd never dream of. It. There's even a scene where he walks in and doesn't even bow. I mean, they were so sclerotic there that you can just imagine. No, he thinks she's rubber-stamped his directorship of the Paris Opera. Then when he discovers she hasn't, well, he ticks her off.
But Richard, this is so redolent of the experiences of our late great Prime Minister, now, of course, Daily Mail columnist extraordinaire, who indeed has actually written a passionate piece, which almost brought me to tears yesterday, about how the injections he took to actually reduce his calorific intake haven't worked. And as a result of that, he's still actually going to rely on good old-fashioned willpower, much like Julius Caesar did, to actually cope with the ineptitudes and vicissitudes of life. Yes, indeed, Richard, I can tell that although you would have been gutted by the demise of the Spotify series on the Sussexes, at least you had some solace in the fact that Boris Johnson has now got a weekly column every Saturday in the Daily Mail. Thank heavens for supporting narratives of history, which will surely, obviously, lift us up through a whole new dimension.
Alex, I can only say you put it beautifully. What more can I say?
Well, I mean, we can actually consider the interlocking stories of two young Oglala Lakota men growing up on the Pine Ridge Reservation, which actually was released back in 2022. 1 hour and 55 minutes of joy and strange storytelling happenings called War Pony.
Oh, the baby boy.
His mama got locked up. She needs to go bail her.
I ain't got time for this.
What kind of dog is it?
I don't even know. She was just outside of my house. Wanna buy her?
I'm gonna get a job soon.
Oh, yeah?
I can get a phone and talk to my girl.
You ain't got no girl.
You're a really good dancer. Thanks. Can I have a kiss?
I don't want to talk to you right now.
Why? I'm a changed man. Hey, you guys hiring?
Hey, you might be in luck with the job.
I heard you got an expensive new dog and a fancy job.
You mad at me?
No, I don't expect much from you.
Don't bring no drama into my TV, okay?
What's up?
I don't want you here no more.
If you let me stay, I'll work for you for free.
I don't speak Lakota.
I ain't trying to be with someone who can't even get through high school.
You know that you're not any different from them.
I'm really sorry.
Everything's gonna be different this time.
Yes, that's in fact, it's rather good. It's interesting, actually. This is a movie made by Riley Keough and Gina Gamel. They filmed it on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and they'd filmed some of a film that I was deeply, deeply fond of, a wonderfully spontaneous movie called American Honey. And they had contact with the reservation there and wanted to return and make a film about the lives of those actually living in it. And it won the Camera d'Or in Cannes for the best first feature, which I did think was remarkable. Yes, it's about these interlocking lives of those who an existence on the reservation is a listless existence. You drift, and drifting, a phrase used for someone on a camel in Lawrence of Arabia, falling asleep and then dangerously falling on the ground and getting swept away, which he rescues one in fact. But here, yes, you've got two characters, very different. One's 23, Bill, played by Jojo Batista Whiting, and he's a father of two with two different mothers, and he makes easy money any way he can in one way or another. There is a dog involved here. What happens to it is somewhat significant, but also there is an entrepreneur who lives nearby, and Bill has a job, and this is going to be a pretty difficult job, it's perfectly obvious, driving young women to and from his home. Clearly that's illegal, but then legality isn't something that they really, I mean, Matthew 12, for example, who's dealing in meths, he's an abusive father, he's kicked out of his home, it's a thoroughly unhappy childhood. But on the other hand, what do they do, but in point of fact, how does the story relate to both of them, and also how could a turkey farm feature somewhat humorously in certain climactic scenes? This movie, it is 2 hours, and I have to say it wore me down a little, because with a lot of movies, I notice they're very, very accurately trying to get the lighting correct, and also in certain circumstances you wouldn't have very bright light. But if a lot of the movie is in fact told in the dark or in very dark circumstances, that can make it a little bit difficult. I thought that there's some very fine visuals. We don't see perhaps quite as many as we could, but the way, as I say, life becomes an endless drift when they drift into circumstances that are involve violence or involve drugs or involve difficulties, it gives you an accurate picture of the lives of certain individuals. In making gripping drama of it is slightly more difficult. There is certainly an extraordinary scene at the entrepreneur's house where there's a macabre Halloween party. And then it's perfectly obvious that Bill is going to have to think through very carefully what is going on with his easy money, because he's working for the entrepreneur and also he's involved in taking women where it's perfectly obvious they've been abused. So there's a drama in this. A lot of this is a very sad movie, and because symbolically we see Buffalo appear quite literally, it's a fairly crude symbol perhaps, but one thinks at the time when Native Americans of course had their own lands before they were taken, and the vast herds of buffalo roamed on them, as we've seen in some of the Hollywood movies. That is what the symbolic buffalo seems to refer to, though I thought it a bit unnecessary. But it's a movie where they're very, very good central performances. Jojo Bautista Whiting as Bill and LaDamian Crazy Thunder as Matho, and they have made every effort, undoubtedly, to make this a movie which reflects life on the reservation and also pays tribute to those whom they got on so well during the filming of it. There's little doubt they're very committed. As I say, you want a bit more drama, but it is very well done.
We really should bring in our Native American experts, Randy Reinholtz and Jean Bruce Scott, to comment on this. But Kathy Manso, in their absence, your thoughts on this one, given that it's 20 minutes shorter than Into the Spider-Verse. So Into the Spider-Verse, 2 hours, 20 minutes. This one, Richard says, too long, 2 hours.
Oh, I have a lot to say. I think, the thing that separates a lot of us here is that I grew up in the United States and we do take Native American history very seriously. It is definitely part of our education growing up. And so when I think anywhere else, there can be, I'm not saying that countries can't relate, because I think there's previous histories that are quite relatable with this. For example, Australia. I don't think I need to comment on that. And I'm sure you will continue to comment on that. But from the US, when it comes to reservations, like I know what's the reservation in Miami. I know it's the Miccosukee tribe that I live next to, and we're close to the Okeechobee. I also know that Miami-Dade County was named after the second bloodiest Native American war that ever happened, and it was under the General Dade, and that's why it was named under that. And I think for anyone that doesn't understand this history, you should do yourself a service into just doing a little bit. So I would recommend reading. There's this writer by the name of Alexi Sherman, and he's Native American Indian, and he wrote a beautiful 2-page short story about his upbringing in both a reservation and at an all-white school as well. And it's a bit of fiction, but if you can give, if you were able to give 2 hours, I think you can give 2 pages to read this. And my favorite line comes from the first grade paragraph. So in first grade, you're about 6 years old. And I think it's incredible, because when you're six, imagine a six-year-old saying, but he wasn't the warrior I was. And I chanted, it's a good day to die. It's a good day to die, all the way down to the principal's office, which I think is phenomenal.
He probably thought you were Klingon, Kathy.
Pretty much, yeah. But I think it will help understand people a little bit more when it comes to the modern aspect of Native American and take them away from the concept of what we're thinking from the 1600s, 1700s. I mean, if you want to take the time to read about the Trail of Tears, by all means, take your time. It is truly horrific. But if you want to understand a better, more modern version, I'd recommend this PDF called Indian Education by Sherman Alexie. So, but I think it'll help understand the movie. And I think I probably will want to watch it just because I have such a knowledge already about it.
I suspect a 9 from yourself, Richard, for this one.
I go actually because of the length, because as I say, certain dramatic aspects. I think had I done the reading that Kathy recommended, I might go further, but certainly 8. Mm.
Natasha, given obviously the native Australian scenario, is this one for yourself as well to compare and contrast two former colonies and how they've got on with obviously their indigenous occupiers?
Yeah, it's a very interesting one, just especially coming off the back of National Sorry Day and Reconciliation Week. It's one of those topics that it's not very well known about, particularly the modern aspects, as Kathy said. It's something that we look at quite extensively, trying to teach, you know, teaching in the schools here. We try and, you know, help the children understand that the depictions that sometimes they get of Indigenous cultures are very quite archaic sort of depictions, and, you know, Indigenous families can live modern lives in modern cities and, you know, a part of the community. But a lot of people don't seem to think that. They just think that they're these people who live away in the bush and we never sort of see them, which is really sad sort of way of being, because when you engage with that culture and you see, you know, you sort of start bringing in some of their knowledge systems, it can be really rewarding. And you think about the ways in which what they can teach us about the land, what they can teach us about, you know, all these different ways of, you know, medicines and ways of working with the land and nature. It's really beautiful. I wish that there were more modern stories told, as Kathy said. I think that this is a really interesting story, that is particularly watching it from the trailer. I think that it's probably suffering a little bit from what Richard's saying, in that you can't really see a lot of the drama in the trailer. It just seems to be a bit slice of lifey, which I guess is what it's going for, but I could see how that wouldn't maybe make it as appealing to a mass audience as something like a big epic Superman movie, which is unfortunately is a shame, because I think that these stories need to be told and there needs to be a heck of a lot more of them. So going forward, I would like to see this be successful. I would like to see this movie. I would like to see more of them made in lots of different iterations, because obviously different lands, different people, there will be so many different stories to tell. There will be common threads, but there will be differences to them as well, and individualities. I just hope that there is some hope in the movie as well, because you seem to see movies set in this modern time that you, if the ones that you do see, it tends to be very sad, which is probably what Richard said is coming across in the theme. I like to think that there is some element of hope in the movie as well, because you want to think that, you know, you don't just want people like this, they're very obviously very proud people coming from where they come from with their cultures and their identities, and you don't want it to just be portrayed as sad. So I'm hoping that there is an element of hope in there, because I feel like that would be doing justice then to the people as well.
And again, just as we were not to confuse Chevalier with anything to do with Maurice Chevalier, do not confuse this with anything to do with War Horse. It's not a prequel to War Horse, despite the fact it's called War Pony, as opposed to War Horse. Easily done. Thank heavens the Spider-Verse can knit all of these things together. To Natasha Wanton in Australia, Kathy Matso, of course, and Richard Fitzwilliams, thank you as ever, and keep watching those movies. We'll be right back.
Thank you.